This podcast is part of an occasional series of interviews and conversations on issues related to educational change. Today, Tom Hatch talks with Eric Schwartz, founder of Citizen Schools and author of The Opportunity Equation, How Citizen Teachers Are Combating the Achievement Gap in America's Schools. They talk about the key ideas with which Citizen Schools began, how the Citizen Schools model has evolved, and what has and hasn't changed in the process.
Eric, if you could just tell me a little bit about sort of what some of the key ideas were that that you started with in terms of Citizen Schools, and then what happened when your initial model sort of interacted with schools. What did you learn from that?
Sure. Well, thanks for doing this, Tom. This started about 20 years ago. The core ideas were that kids needed more learning time, and that upper-income kids were getting that additional time in all kinds of formal and informal ways, and lower-income kids not as much. And second, that we needed to find a way to get many more citizens, professionals, tradespeople, serving as mentors to kids. And that we, one idea that could happen in the after-school space or in schools is we could sort of democratize or open up what it means to be a teacher and create different types of teachers. Clearly full-time master teachers at the core, but in addition, some apprentice teachers who might be AmeriCorps members who are, earning a little bit less and, have lesser responsibilities but play a really important role in the whole fabric or human resources fabric of the school. And then what we call citizen teachers who are volunteers. The other goal was more kind of project-based, hands-on learning.
Uh-huh.
Felt then and even feels maybe more today was being squeezed out of a lot of schools.
Yeah.
And so after school felt like a great place to kind of get that going.
And just in terms of the project-based learning, though, apprenticeship was a central idea from the beginning?
Yeah. The core idea from the beginning, the name Citizen Schools, was really about the idea of getting citizens teaching kids how to do what they do, whether that be architecture or law or, I used to be a journalist, and the very first class was me teaching 10 kids how to publish a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the core insight. And then we wrapped around that some academic coaching, and the academic side of the program was very thin in the beginning. It was sort of homework help and not a whole lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, that's evolved a lot. And it's varied a lot school to school based on the particular needs and approach of the school. Something you said earlier resonates around you need to have some flexibility in how you build out your program.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you also need to have a few things at the absolute core that you won't compromise on.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go back to the early years and what we sort of learned from that, but I'd say the two things that have been at the absolute core that we haven't compromised on have been, one, apprenticeships. We've had schools that said, will you come and just don't do the apprenticeships. That's nice, but we just want to do more academic coaching. And that's not our model. We don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We only want to be running programs where kids take 4 apprenticeships per year, and that's a big part of the model. And then we also want to always do some academics. And that really comes from our experience in the first 5 years of the program, when we were pretty bad at the academic side of things, and we would have kids who had these amazing experiences in their apprenticeships. They loved them. I think it helps them learn in some very profound and powerful ways, but it did not change their grades in the near term, in the early years. And we'd have a lot of parents saying to us, sorry, my kid's not going to do citizen schools anymore.
Yep.
They're failing math class. And that feedback that we got less from schools, but a little bit from schools, and also from parents in the first sort of 3 years of citizen schools made us adapt and pushed us to get good at academic coaching and practice along with getting good at apprenticeships. And so that changes things in a good way. And I can get more into, as we've gotten more into schools, how we've changed. But I would say from the beginning, we were really trying to drive disruptive change, not so much in schools, but in education writ large. And we were trying to change the after-school sector from afterthought, graham crackers and basketball, to a full partner with schools and parents in raising healthy kids. And so our goal there, again, was less to fundamentally change the structure of schools. We believed in running after-school programs that were based in a school and that had some connection to the school. But it was a pretty light-touch connection. We needed space. We didn't ask for any money in the beginning. We really needed space, and we wanted to have, you know, over time we wanted access to, you know, data about the students. But in the beginning, we really didn't even need that. We just needed space. And what we were trying to disrupt was the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, and other kind of mom-and-pop after-school programs, and encourage them to think differently and think a little bolder about what they could do with their slice of time that they had kids for. And I would say that we were fairly successful in that mission. I remember conversations with Harold Sparrow, who's the head of the Roxbury YMCA, who said, we used to, you know, be a graham crackers and basketball program. That's what we thought kids wanted. That was sort of what we did. And then you guys came along, and a lot of the private funders started saying, oh, Citizen School is the new kid on the block, and they're doing some pretty cool stuff. And it seems to be pretty imaginative. You know, why don't you do that? And I do think, and on this book tour, I've been going around the country meeting people who've been tracking our work for the last 15, 20 years. I do think there's a lot of after-school programs that have raised the bar and have thought about how to incorporate, you know, experiential learning, project-based learning, mentors from the community in deeper ways. And the whole after-school field has blossomed in a lot of ways.
So, yeah, go ahead.
What was interesting, though, so the arc of Citizen Schools, so the first, you know, 10 years, we ran an after-school program, first 8 years only in Boston, then we started growing outside of Boston. The academic side of it got more and more serious because of feedback from schools who said, we're not going to give you the space anymore unless you help us meet our academic goals. Mm-hmm. And parents who said, you know, my kid, you know, I'm not going to have prioritize my kid going to your program unless you help us meet our academic goals. And we realized that our apprenticeships really are a big part of how we help kids academically. They help motivate kids. They build good learning habits, and they build, they teach kids a lot. But that we also need to give kids practice in math and practice in reading and writing. And that you can do those two things. You don't have to choose between those two. So we went from, maybe an hour or two of homework a week to a model that has, you know, maybe 3 hours of homework plus 3 hours of academic coaching plus two apprenticeships every week. And then in the spring semester, two more apprenticeships.
So, but did that that didn't fundamentally change the nature of the apprenticeships? Did it allow you to focus in the apprenticeships on what was most effective, or did you just learn that you didn't need that much time on the apprenticeships?
Well, no, what happened is we just added more time overall. So we didn't do less on the apprenticeships. We added more non-apprenticeship time. So in the early years, we were just, you know, two afternoons a week for a couple hours a day. Then it was apprenticeships and not much more. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, now we're 3 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. And we used to be 20 weeks of the year, and now we're 40 weeks of the year. Mm-hmm. So it's just it's massive. It's grown from, you know, an 80 hour a year program to about 450 hour a year program. Mm-hmm. So huge increase in dosage. Mm-hmm. And the apprenticeship part has stayed about the same. It's gotten better, I think. The quality of the curriculum, the courses have gotten better. But the amount of time has stayed about the same. And the amount of time on other activities, a lot of them academic focused, but also some field trips and some trips to college campuses, has increased dramatically.
Right, but so one critical aspect of, I mean, so that's a fairly dramatic expansion in terms of the so-called instructional time, or the time within the program. How were you able to make sure that you had the capacity to both, you know, deliver effective apprenticeships, but also effective tutoring and homework help?
We changed our staffing model. So we went from a part-time frontline staff of mostly people sort of in college, kind of working for us 15 hours a week, to a AmeriCorps teaching fellow model with people full-time for 2 years after college. So that means both more expensive and better. We went from part-time campus directors in the very beginning, first couple of years, to full-time campus directors who really essentially served as vice principals for the school, focused on the extended hours. We built more infrastructure around the training and coaching and curriculum development and evaluation of all the programs. So big change there. The fundamental change, which was really it's just an interesting realization, so we started doing rigorous evaluation about 5 years in, and 10 years in, had a study from Policy Studies Associates that was a quasi-experimental design, very rigorous, and looked at 1,000 kids in the program against 1,000 matched comparison kids. Mm-hmm. And we learned from that that we were having a big impact. And, you know, kids in our program who were significantly below average on their fourth grade MCAS scores and more likely to be special needs students and more likely to be English language learners, by 10th grade, they were at average for the state of Massachusetts in passing the MCAS. They finished high school at the same rate as middle-income peers around the country. So we're having some real success in helping kids beat the odds and narrowing or even fully closing achievement gaps. But we fundamentally were not changing the schools that we were in.
Right.
Which is really interesting. That was primarily because we were working with like 15 to 20% of the kids in those schools.
Yep.
And they were having a good experience. They were doing better. I think we were doing a good job of not creaming, but we just weren't hitting critical mass.
Yep.
And schools had changed us, I think, in a good way. They'd made us better on the academics without abandoning the apprenticeships. But we hadn't changed schools.
Yeah.
And then we had the chance in Charlestown, Massachusetts, in the neighborhood of Boston, to do the Edwards School, which has been studied heavily, a chapter in the book about, which was every kid. And it was part of a statewide experiment in 10 schools. Interestingly, most of the schools chose to add, you know, a couple hundred, like 300 hours at the minimum. They added the minimum of 300 hours, and they did it primarily with their same teachers, paying them overtime.
Right.
And in 8 out of 9 cases, that did not work well, at least in terms of lifting up academic performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some, you know, because teachers are tired at the end of the day, and, more of the same is fundamentally not a game changer. The Edwards, ironically, because they didn't have enough teachers who wanted to opt into that, and a little bit because of some bus schedule issues, chose to do it in an innovative different way, which was to hire us to do, you know, for most of their kids, do the extra learning time. And some teachers were there, but in a much, in a secondary role. And they got excellent results, transformative results. And for us, that convinced us that we, you know, hard as it would be, there was a role we could play in actually migrating from after school to expanded learning time, which we define as actually redefining what school is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still, a lot of people still call it after school because it's sort of after the traditional day, but it really isn't after school. It's just changing the definition of school from a 6-hour day to a 9-hour day,
mm-hmm.
changing the definition of who's a teacher from a full-time certified teacher always to, yes, a full-time certified teacher for 6 hours, but a non-certified kind of apprentice teacher or volunteer for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing now in about 30 schools around the country and delivering, you know, some really very strong results. Uncertain, and we've learned a lot about you know, what are the conditions for success? And it doesn't work when there's not a strong principal. But I think we have some pretty good evidence that, it is working well beyond the impact of the strong principal alone.
So
like strong principals, in some cases, were in these schools for a couple of years, trying really hard, not making a change, and then ELT started and the results started changing. Or, you know, two schools, both with strong principals, one with ELT, the one with ELT takes off. Or a lot of schools were in our K-8 schools.
Yep.
Sixth through eighth grade has gone to a much longer day, and the, you know, third, fourth, and fifth grade haven't. And the test scores have gone up a little bit in third, fourth, and fifth, but not much, and gone up a ton in sixth, seventh, and eighth.
And that has been the focus for the most part in terms of citizen schools in general. It's been on middle school, but in some of these ELT schools, you're starting to work in the third, fourth, and the fifth grades.
No, we're not. I'm drawing the contrast that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Evidence is working. This, like Orchard Garden, is a very successful turnaround in Boston that we were involved with, and a lot of people have said, "Oh, yeah, well, you probably contributed to that." But mostly, what happened is you had a great principal, and it was a turnaround school, so they changed out a lot of the teachers. And you know, we've pointed out, well, those things are all true. But if you look at the third, fourth, and fifth grade changes, they're actually pretty modest, and they had that same great principal, the same benefit of changing out the teachers, etc. And the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, when they've gone to this ELT schedule with citizen schools, the changes have been much more profound.
I see. That's really interesting. But that does, again, raise the question, and I want to come back to the notion of disrupting the after-school space, but in terms of working in the regular, you know, within the school, the parameters of the school, it still sounds like the citizen schools is operating kind of at one part of the day, and pretty much it's school as usual for the other part of the day. Is that fair?
It's some, you know, chapter 12 gets into this some, Tom, in the book, and I think it's fair to say that, you know, in the majority of the extended learning time schools for the first 3 years, that's mostly true. The first 6 hours haven't changed that much. I think teachers can be a little more effective because students are a little more motivated and they've done their homework and they're a little extra coaching and mentoring after school, and they might care about math more because they see how it links to rocket science or,
right,
you know, Android apps that they're creating in their apprenticeships. But we haven't done a whole lot of super creative stuff to influence the first 6 hours. That's starting to change. There's starting to be some more overlap blocks where, you know, maybe just for the seventh period of the day, the regular teacher and the AmeriCorps teaching fellow team teach. And that's a pretty cool model where it allows, you know, often the way people will use that is the master teacher will introduce a lesson, and then the AmeriCorps person will take over the class, and the teacher, the teacher of record, will pull out a couple of kids at a time for some sort of pull-out tutoring on a particular concept, which is something a teacher rarely gets the chance to do. And so that's a pretty cool opportunity. Or you can break a class of, you know, 26 kids into two groups of 13, and that's sometimes for some lessons is a good thing. Or you can just have the AmeriCorps member pull out a couple of kids for extra tutoring,
mm-hmm,
or, you know, reinforce learning in the class in some way. So we're trying to do more of that. And we have not yet brought the volunteers in to the school beyond the, you know, afternoon hours.
Mm-hmm.
But that logically should happen at all times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So the disruptive innovation I would like to see over time would be a school saying, great, we definitely want to have the, you know, Google engineers teaching apprenticeships from 3 to 5. That's great. It's probably convenient time for them. But we'd also love to see if some of them be willing to come in and kind of co-teach 11th grade math or co-teach 7th grade math or social studies, you know, in the morning, because that, you know, might really enrich a set of lessons as well.
So I think you're really hitting on a key issue. So part of, I mean, it sounds like you've discovered some opportunities for flexibility, introducing other adults and volunteers, in a sense, you know, building the educational and instructional capacity of the school with these extended hours and some of the opportunities for collaboration. But the rub is, how do we get that into a schedule and that fits both the school, the kids, and those other adults who need to come in?
Mm-hmm. Right. And how do we get schools where a nurse is a powerful force in life generally, and a nurse is a particularly powerful force, I think, in public schools. There's so much habit, so hard to sort of break from the status quo, either in budgets or HR practices or teaching practices. And I think one of the things that's kind of cool about Expanded Learning Day is there's a little less resistance to innovation in the sort of 2 to 5 p.m.
Right.
But now that it's expanded learning time, it's actually part of the school. So when it was at the school, you could be really innovative, but it wasn't connected to the school as much. Now you can be, I think, just as innovative, but it's more connected to the school. And it's a little more of a kind of camel's nose under the tent, a little more of an opportunity to move some of those practices towards infiltrating the traditional day. And also just to, at a kind of policy level, it's an opportunity for people to think differently. And maybe the traditional day doesn't need to be disrupted that much.
Mm-hmm.
What's needed is just a 6-hour day of kind of academic teaching and coaching, and we can try to get better at that, but that's basically what that should be used for. But then what's been missing all these years is a 3-hour part of the day that's focused primarily on enrichment and a little bit on individualized remediation. And the combination of those two things, looks very much like what happens in the suburbs, right? The suburbs don't have tons of project-based learning. They don't have a 9-hour day. They have a 6-hour day in school, a 6.5-hour day. But what they do have that inner-city communities generally don't have is lots and lots of enrichment that might happen in an after-school program or might happen through a series of kind of clubs and enrichment activities that parents organize for kids, and they pay for in most cases. And they also have individualized remediation, either by tutors or by parents. And that combination of individualized academic remediation and coaching, homework around the kitchen table with usually mom there to kind of help and coach, plus a lot of enrichment, sports, arts, robotics camp, plus the 6 or 7-hour school day, works in most American, middle, top middle class communities.
Hmm. And
I think in many ways what ELT do is just ELT is bringing that same thing to lower income communities.
Yeah. Now, and just briefly in terms of, so one of the issues you talk about is there might have been some additional space in the extra extended learning time for flexibility, for some innovation, and now, maybe it's getting the camel's nose under the tent and we're able to integrate a little bit more of that into the regular school day. But because you were in the ELT time, you also didn't have as much of the pressure for demonstrating immediate academic results in your first 5 years, did you? You needed to show it to the parents in terms of the grades, but you had this 5 to 10 years to demonstrate the organizational results. Is that right?
Well, the first 3 to 5 years, we did not have the same need, but in about year 3, our founding principal, we started just, in the early days of No Child Left Behind and the MCAS in Massachusetts rolled out, became high stakes, I think, in 97, in our second or third year. And that's changed things. School principals, even though they weren't paying anything, they were giving us some time and some space. And they came to us and said, look, if you're going to stay here and be our after-school program, you've got to do more to lift up academic results. Because they were under such
right
pressure to deliver results. And we could have said, no, forget that. You know, we're going to start running the program out of libraries or
books.
But we embraced that. And I think it was, we were one of the few programs that said, hey, look, we can use sort of youth development principles to deliver academic education reform results.
Yeah. And but that's also something that you have to deal with a changed environment now if you're working in schools in terms of demonstrating your ability to, you know, be successful from the get-go in terms of your work throughout the school day, right?
Yep. So we're now, you know, but that's our calling card with schools is to say we embrace being your partner in lifting up results. We, you know, we know that you want to do more than just get your kids to do well on the test. And we want to do a lot more than that, but we also know that doing better on the test is, you know, maybe necessary but insufficient. And we will be your partner in helping kids do better, but you know, have a higher percentage of them be proficient, lower percentage fail, do better in their grades, and then also be on a pathway where, if we were to measure long term, more of them would finish high school, more would finish college, and be, you know, prepared for successful lives as adults.
Right. And it's, I mean, it's interesting because in a way you've managed to take advantage of the indicators that are used and that are out there, although you're also possibly well positioned if we are able to come up with some wider measures of socio-emotional development and other aspects, that you might also be able to show some progress there.
Definitely. And we sort of assume that people kind of trust that we build some of the socio-emotional skills. And so we haven't, we measure some of those things, and we're part of a few coalitions trying to figure out how to measure them better.
Right.
But we've sort of, I've taken the view that people probably assume we do those things well. People don't assume we can do the academics. So we want to kind of take some extra time to prove that we can do that well as well. Also.
Right. Well, so just maybe picking up a little bit on the notion of being disruptive in the after-school space, and I think it's really helpful to think about the way, you know, Citizen Schools, in a sense, is operating in two spaces at once, both the after-school space and the, you know, more formal school space. But where do you see things going in the future? What kinds of changes do you think Citizen Schools or that kind of approach can make? What else is needed in order to see even further improvements?
Is it in the after-school space or in the?
Well, it's really where are you seeing, you know, where do you see it going next? It sounds like you're really, the Citizen Schools is paying more attention to the formal school space in some ways, but is it also working in the after-school, continuing the after-school space push as well?
Yeah, I think it's definitely both. I mean, I think we and our new CEO, Stephen Rothstein, are thinking a lot about how to bring Citizen Schools and its ideas to scale. And the model we have of the sort of school improvement, school turnaround, you know, 450 plus hours, you know, 20 AmeriCorps members in a school, that's very intensive. We, you know, we'd like to grow that from 30 to 50, you know, maybe 100 schools in 6 to 10 years. But it's probably not going to be in 1,000 schools run by us. But we think through policy work and through maybe testing some other models where potentially in some schools where they may have like their academic stuff together, but they really could use help with the apprenticeships. We might test an idea of we come in as a much lighter touch, just doing the apprenticeships, which we resisted early on because we were in schools where kids were getting very poorly served academically.
Mm-hmm.
But there might be a set of schools where and this might be actually a way to partner with some of the charter schools or some district schools that have really kind of gotten some momentum on the basic academic remediation and work, but are really looking to help kids develop a broader set of skills and have more enrichment, more well-rounded education. And we could come in and grow faster in this way doing just the apprenticeships. So that's one idea. We'd like also to sort of have a lot more of the best after-school programs make the same migration that we did to moving from after-school to extended learning time. And that's starting to happen. program called Higher Achievements, Bell, Cityear even, are starting to do, you know, some of the schools in some parts of the country where they, you know, they team up with a school to deliver for all kids in a grade or in a school an 8 or 9 or 10 hour day.
Right. And so one of the chief constraints that it seems like you're running up against is just the cost and the time and the number of people it takes to do the turnaround model itself. Is that right?
Yeah. I think it's any, you know, any, if you try to grow by sharing curriculum, you could grow really fast. You're probably not going to make a big difference.
Right.
If you try to grow through actually an organization where you have to hire people and fire people and, you know, do all that, whether it's the private sector or the nonprofit sector, it's very, very hard to grow faster than, you know, 15 to 20% a year.
Right.
Even that's really fast. You know, so that compounds. If you double every 4 years, which is, and we've been growing that fast, if not faster, eventually that does start compounding some pretty big numbers, but it takes a long time. And so if you can find a way to coach others on what you're doing and really change the expectation in urban schools where, you know, just the way early childhood has become a new normal. You know, it's now you do a debate about exactly how early you start and exactly how you do it, or special education. You know, 50 years ago, there was no sort of separate training or money for certain special education students, or very little, and now there's $70 billion. And so if we could think about finding a way that expanded learning time could become a new normal, with citizen schools helping to set a standard of excellence, but a range of other programs doing it in different ways, but hopefully following some of the same principles.
Well, that's really helpful and a nice look to the future. It gives us a little bit of a glimpse and a thought about extended learning time and where we might go with that. Anything else you want to add in terms of what you see coming down the road, the kinds of disruptions that might come along or that might be needed?
I mean, I think the big issue in education in terms of inequality is there are going to be all kinds of innovative disruptions. And, you know, the Khan Academy is one that's cited a lot. And I think most of the disruptive technologies and innovations that come along are going to be adopted faster and better in upper-income communities and slower and less well in low-income communities, because the upper-income communities have more momentum, they have more support, they have more social capital, and they have parents sort of really pushing for the best, and parents have access to a lot of resources. And so that's a really interesting and troublesome concern that we have to wrestle with. If we have more and more innovation, and the innovation accelerates the achievement gap, which is what's been happening the last 30 years,
right.
That's a real problem for the country.
Yep.
And I think expanded learning time becomes not a full solution to that. Nothing's going to be a full solution, but it becomes a pretty powerful tool. Because it creates a structure and a sort of intermediary opportunity to bring in not one, but a whole lot of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if citizen school is in your school and you have a 9 hour day instead of a 6 hour day, your chances to use Khan Academy are much higher.
Yeah.
Your chances to use, you know, to some of your video game develops that kids love and it teaches them math really, really well. But a lot of parents don't have access to, you know, the internet at home, so they won't use it. You have a longer learning day, and you have a bunch of AmeriCorps teaching fellows. They could, you know, get kids using that video game to learn math in cool new ways.
That's really helpful. And in part, what I hear in this story, in a sense, is there are disruptions, there are innovations that are going on in different spheres that citizen schools have been involved in the school space, in the after-school space, but I think in the end you're really reminding us that if, you know, it's not just about disrupting innovation or disrupting education, it's about disrupting inequality.
Right, exactly. There are a set of forces that are making inequality get bigger and bigger, and we need to think about what are the opposing forces. And the answer can't be to hold back the wealthy kids, because that's not going to happen. And, you know, our society benefits from those kids learning a ton, too, and becoming more innovative. But we have to think much more proactively than we have in the past about how we can bring a set of resources to lower-income kids that upper-income kids take for granted.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. I will. I know this ended up going longer than it should have, but you're just very eloquent on all these things, and I tried not to get involved in a discussion with you because it would be really interesting to pursue some of these issues further. One thing I might try and do is sort of chart out a little bit some of the changes and adaptations that you described. Just as an illustration for my class, and I might just, you know, share that with you as well. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to boil all this down because there was really a ton of stuff there. But whatever we do, we're not going to post anything without showing it to you first. So it'll probably take us a week
at
least to process something. Anyway.
I appreciate you doing it, and thanks. It'll be good visibility, and the more you can get people in your circles talking about both the book and about citizen schools, the better. That's awesome.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of the trip, and, you know, one of these days when you get back to Boston, let's get some golf in.
That sounds good. Thank you, Tom.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
Okay.
Bye.